My name is Erin O'Brien, and I am the membership editor at War on the Rocks. This is The Insider, the members-only podcast where we ask War on the Rocks authors to reflect on their articles and why they matter for national security. Today, I am joined by Drew Thompson, author of Lai Ching Does First 100 Days and What It Tells Us About the Future. Drew was the director for China, Taiwan, and Mongolia in the Office of the Secretary of Defense from 2011 to 2018. He is now a senior fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies at Nanyang Technical University in Singapore. Welcome to The Insider.
Thank you for having me.
So usually we start off this podcast by asking authors to tell us a little bit more about their argument, but since your article is tied directly to, you know, Lai's first 100 days in office, the beginning of his administration, I was wondering if you could start off by just telling us pretty frankly about what you've seen in Lai's first 100 days in office.
I've been watching Taiwan politics for maybe 20 years and working very closely with Taiwan's leaders, military officials, as well as, you know, interacting with other friends. And it's really quite something to watch Taiwan's democracy in action, regardless of the political party in office. And in a way, what's really, I guess, heartwarming, right? I mean, what really makes Taiwan so intriguing and so interesting is the vibrancy of its democracy, you know, the high turnouts, going to Taiwan for election days and watching people in the streets just taking the day off and going to vote, and the sense of community that it builds. When I look at this first 100 days, I mean, I think about, there have been many presidents' first 100 days in Taiwan, and it's a very normal kind of special transition, if that makes sense. And it's not, you know, it's not a given in Asia, particularly Northeast Asia, right? This is the only Chinese democracy. This is a country that has direct presidential elections, not a parliamentary system. I mean, the Japanese prime minister, it's a very democratic system, but, you know, selected by the party, not by the voters. So to me, the first 100 days is really a kind of a celebration of democracy, and then how each president chooses to govern, you know, based on the will of the people. I think to me, that's really the most important and underlying part of it. It's not just sort of business as usual. We have to step back and really appreciate what we've just seen, right? The peaceful transfer of power between two senior leaders. And we've now had the peaceful transfer of power both between parties and within a party. So to me, that's significant. Now, how Lai has actually governed over the 3 months since he was inaugurated, pretty routine, right? Like any president, he deals with building a cabinet, pulling his people together, getting smart on issues. He had the advantage of being the vice president for the last 4 years. So he kind of knows what he's up against and what he has to deal with, and he knows the players. But, you know, it's very different being the vice president and advising the president to actually being the president. So what he's done is shuffled the cabinet, kept some of the key people, but brought in some new people. He's had to deal with something that his predecessors haven't always had to deal with, which is a split government where the opposition party, Kuomintang, controls the legislative yuan. So you've got, you know, the opposition parties to manage. And of course, he's got to deal with a very threatening and coercive neighbor across the Taiwan Strait in China. So what he's had to deal with is similar to what, you know, his predecessor Tsai Ing-wen had to deal with. So in some ways, it's kind of reassuring continuity that he's followed Tsai Ing-wen's approach of not being unnecessarily adversarial towards China, not provoking them, also maintaining his relationships with the United States and building trust with, you know, U.S. allies and partners, and building relations with, you know, his counterparts around the world that, you know, also have a stake in Taiwan's democracy, economy, and its future. So Lai has stepped into, you know, a set of shoes that have been pretty well walked in, and I think he's managed the transition pretty well.
And I want to dig into the China question a bit more. I mean, how exactly has Lai positioned himself vis-a-vis, as you say, the neighbor across the Taiwan Strait? And what can this tell us about how he's likely to govern with regards to China for the remainder of his administration?
Lai Ching-te, like every Taiwan president, has to manage and balance his relationships. And he has to deal with an adversarial relationship with Beijing. He has to maintain a relationship with Washington, D.C., and ensure that Washington is confident and trustful of him. And of course, he needs to have a sustainable and productive relationship with the people of Taiwan, not just his, you know, his voters and supporters, but, you know, undecided and sort of centrist people, as well as, you know, the opposition parties, right? I mean, he's the governor of the country, not just his party. So I think what Lai has sought to do is manage all of those constituencies. And of course, the challenge with China was they never really gave him a chance. You know, they had him pegged as somebody who sort of was the embodiment of everything that Beijing thinks is wrong with Taiwan politics. Lai once described himself in 2017 as a pragmatic worker for Taiwan independence. And obviously some of that was, you know, election hyperbole, and he was, you know, speaking to his base of you know, pro-independence supporters, which is, you know, essentially the status quo. But Beijing really took exception to that clause, that phrase, but they felt that it really embodied his intentions, his true nature. And as a result, Beijing has absolutely no willingness to give him the benefit of the doubt, to wonder if he'll change his stripes. So he's basically walking into a cross-strait relationship with an adversary that doesn't trust him, refuses to trust him, and won't attempt to trust him. So he doesn't really have any incentive to make concessions to Beijing or to try to meet them halfway because of that deep level of distrust and really unwillingness to open channels of communication with him. So he faces a tough challenge there. And he also has to make sure that he doesn't make that relationship worse, because that would present more challenges for Taiwan from a security perspective. There's still economic ties. And obviously, that's something that Washington doesn't want, right? Washington wants to avoid cross-strait tension and conflict. And Lai Jingde has to make sure that he is not painted as the one who is provoking Beijing and that he's not the cause of cross-strait tensions. And Beijing makes that job a little easier by being so intractable and by relying so heavily on military coercion. So in that respect, his job is easier, but he can't just pander to diehard separatists within the Taiwan body politic. And he has to, you know, remind them that there's consequences if they push too hard or if they cross invisible lines that provoke a outsized response from China.
So do you think that there is a chance of further or significant Chinese military escalation during Lai's time in office?
I think we've seen very consistent increases in Chinese military operations around Taiwan since 2016, when President Tsai Ing-wen was elected. There's this notion, I think, that, you know, the Chinese military is going to exercise, demonstrate, patrol around Taiwan, and they'll change their patterns. And some of it is clearly exercises. I mean, they're designed to help the PLA prepare for a conflict. Others are very clearly political signaling, and others are perhaps more farther afield, directed more towards the United States and veiled warnings to the United States about PLA's capabilities and resolve. So I don't see anything that indicates that Beijing might be inclined to reduce that military pressure. I'm not even certain that if Lai Jingde were to make significant concessions to China, that they would reciprocate. I mean, I think there's a real risk that whatever concessions Lai Jingde makes, Xi Jinping just pockets them and says, well, this is what you should have done all along. In which case, he then loses his political credibility at home. He loses support amongst his electoral base. And then he ends up with a Chinese military that's still postured towards coercion and patrolling aggressively and creating more political pressure to ensure that he can't back out. So he has no assurances from China. And foreign policy is essentially based on assurances and deterrence. And if you don't have both, deterrence can fail because you basically trap your opponent. So I think until Beijing is ready to offer some concrete reassurances that moderation has benefits to Lai Jingde, he has absolutely no incentive to commit political suicide by making concessions to Beijing. So that's kind of why the importance of channels is, I think, underappreciated. And the U.S. has been pushing a lot of rhetoric that Beijing should talk to Taiwan and not demand concessions as a precondition for talks, because it's not going to work. It's a brick wall. So until China's ready to do that, I think we've got a path dependency of steadily increasing military coercion. And of course, yesterday we saw China launching an intercontinental ballistic missile clear across the Pacific, not because of anything that Lai Jingde did or anything that was provoked. It's China sending a message to the world.
I want to pull back a bit now. Is there anything about Lai's first 100 days in office that has surprised you?
When you follow something closely, it's good to not be surprised. I try to keep an open mind when I'm doing my political risk analysis so that I'm not surprised. So it's difficult to take me out of that equation. Some things surprise me. I'm not sure, you know, Lai is the cause. I didn't talk about this in the paper, but the third party candidate, the Taiwan People's Party, headed by the former mayor of Taipei, Ko Wen-je, has essentially politically imploded. Ko Wen-je, who was the candidate for president in the election, who won about 25% of the vote overall, essentially ensuring that Lai Ching-te won, he's now been detained on corruption charges. One of the other prominent members of the Taiwan People's Party have been accused of corruption and convicted as a former mayor. So you've got sort of two of the top leaders of one of the key political parties basically disappear. And that changes the political dynamic in a way I didn't expect. It's difficult to see how maybe a third party independent political candidate can play a dominant role in politics. But the speed and the completeness of Ko Wen-je's demise has been quite surprising. And I think President Lai Ching-te has a hand behind that. I mean, the prosecutors are following the law, but they're obviously not constrained politically and are going after candidates both in the Democratic Progressive Party, Lai Ching-te's party, the Kuomintang, and the Taiwan People's Party. So I did not expect an anti-corruption campaign led by the legal system, not by the president, to have such a big political impact. So maybe that surprised me, but certainly, you know, nothing that President Lai has done or the KMT have done have been particularly unexpected.
And now, looking forward, I mean, what do you expect out of the Lai administration? Are there going to be any, you know, signature policy moves, anything like that that you expect in the coming months or years?
Lai Ching-te really hit the ground running when he came into office. And I mentioned this in the article, following on effectively the third term of the DPP, he didn't have to replace all of the sort of KMT trappings of government. He could basically continue to build upon Tsai Ing-wen's legacy. And that means, you know, he doesn't have to do the sort of anything but move that normally a new incumbent has to do. And I think that's enabled him to start defining, you know, his priorities. And one of the, I think, pretty good examples of that is his establishment of three committees that he chairs that are sort of reside within the presidential office. One of them is called the Healthy Taiwan Promotion Committee, so basically a public health committee. One is climate change. And the third is the Whole of Society Resilience Committee, which is basically making civil defense a all of government, all of society issue. And that committee actually convened today on September 26th for the first time, and it's expected to meet quarterly. So basically, by using his position and by using the convening power of the presidential office, he is setting a national agenda on these three key issues: health, climate change, and civil deterrence, civil defense, that really helps him control the narrative. And part of that is a defensive move to prevent the opposition party KMT, which controls the legislature, from dictating the agenda and the narrative. But I think part of it is also his recognition that these are critically important issues that are going to affect Taiwan and Taiwanese people. They are particularly challenging one. I mean, health, of course, in the aftermath of COVID, but, you know, climate change and civil society resilience is, you know, obviously key issues that are not something dealt with by a single government agency that really requires presidential level attention. And I think that's going to be significant going forward, because these are such central issues to people's livelihoods. They are such important issues for the voters that I see those being, if you will, a defining aspect of, you know, the next couple of years of a Lai presidency. Because it's not just about China and the threat of attack. I mean, Taiwan is vulnerable to natural disasters. I mean, they've just suffered through a typhoon. They regularly have earthquakes, and civil defense is a key aspect of the society. And they've made great strides. I mean, Taiwan has massive earthquakes, but rarely do you have widespread damage. You know, one or two buildings may, you know, older buildings may have trouble, but the enforcement of building codes and building regulations are very strict, and they've been very effective at reducing risk. So by making society more resilient, it's going to have, I think, very strategic impacts on how Taiwan views cross-strait relations. I mean, I think the conventional notion is, you know, China's so big, Taiwan is so small, what can you do? You know, hold out as long as you can. But I think he's changing that. He's changing that notion. He's empowering people to deal with risk, whether it's natural disasters or a man-made one in the guise of China. So he's basically giving people not just sort of a notion of a secure future, but also increasing their will to resist and their will to fight and fight for their homeland. And that's going to have impacts on government budgets, on defense spending, on their ability to stand up to bullying and threats and coercion in a way that I think it could be quite transformational in terms of how Taiwan prepares to defend itself from all risks.
All right. Well, unfortunately, that is our time. But thank you so much for coming on The Insider to discuss your piece. And thank you so much for writing for War on the Rocks.
My pleasure. I look forward to more articles in the future.